Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Scott Hibbard, Robert Pape, William Delgado, Mike Miller, and Grant Culp. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where unfortunately we're having phone problems this evening, but our email address is working, brucedumont@museum.tv, brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's @Dumo. Well, the City of Lights is in shock today, and there was a false alarm this afternoon that sent the city into panic. And again, fortunately, there was no incident today other than this false alarm, which really has played havoc with the city that is very much on edge. This comes at a day when the president of France has launched airstrikes against the stronghold of Raqqa in Syria. That's the stronghold of ISIS. He feels that, as he said the other day, that he is at war with ISIS. And again, we'll be talking about that as the program unfolds this evening and the devastation of what transpired a couple of days ago in Paris, France. We are very blessed with a great panel of discussants this evening. And we're going to begin with Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, who is one of the world's foremost authorities on suicide bombing and also on air power. And Robert, thanks very much for being with us tonight to share your expertise. I'd like to begin, first of by talking about the French airstrikes against Raqqa. What do you believe is their intention of these airstrikes? Is it just a feel-good attack, or is there some potential major strategic advancement they can make with their strikes today?
There's no doubt that this will make many people feel good, but I'm also quite sure the purpose of the attack is to kill the top leaders in ISIS. El-Baghdadi in particular, I'm sure, is what the French who the French hope to knock off. And I think that as a secondary goal, what they're hoping is to disrupt the planning of the leadership, because what we are experiencing is not simply a coordinated attack in Paris, but we are experiencing the third major spectacular attack by ISIS in the last 6 weeks. There is good reason to worry that there will be more. And the key in the very short term, this is I want to stress in the very short term, to trying to do something about that is disrupting the leadership planning over the next few weeks.
Now, an article that you wrote in the Boston Globe today suggests that they are somewhat desperate.
Absolutely.
Tell us about why Paris, why now?
Yeah, absolutely. So what many people probably haven't been following the news closely enough, and so they don't really realize that in the last year, the strategy that the United States put together against ISIS has been working. It's been working territorially. What's happened in the last year is that ISIS has lost somewhere between 10% and a quarter of the territory that they had 12 months ago. And in the last 6 weeks, the United States has put together a multi-prong attack for Kurds and Shia ground forces with our air power to attack into Raqqa, where the French just bombed, to attack from Sinjar, to attack into Ramadi. I wish I had a map to explain it, but if you saw the points, the sum total of what we are threatening to do to ISIS is greater than any individual piece, which is why I think ISIS is panicking.
So as they are on the defensive, and Scott Hibbard from DePaul University, I want to get you involved. Your area of expertise is the Middle East as well. This clearly is a game changer. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would.
In what way?
Well, first of all, I think you need to look at why they're attacking France. And my assumption is, based upon what happened in Madrid in 2004, is France had been involved with the coalition in the bombing that's been going on, and so the operatives are trying to raise the price for French involvement. And like Madrid in 2004,
so punish the helpers.
Yeah, and so the hope is that that France would withdraw. I think just the opposite is true. I think, as Bob has kind of highlighted, if anything else, it's steeled the resolve of the French and, quite frankly, of NATO. And I think you're going to see a much more robust response, to ISIS after this.
Now, one of the questions that is before the world at the moment is whether or not, because France is a member of NATO, whether they are going to impose Article 5, which is an attack on one NATO nation is considered an attack on all. The last time that was used was in 9/11, and it was used by the United States. Do you expect France to call and ask for the imposition and the enforcement of Article 5?
I think it's quite likely. I think that it would not be at all surprising. The big issue, though, isn't whether or not we declare war on ISIS. Right. The big question is whether that leads to some massive deployment of ground forces, Bruce. And the just simply declaring Article 5 does not mean that all those 19 NATO countries are going to then contribute many hundreds of thousands of ground troops. I think that what it does is it shows solidarity, and it also recognizes that the coalition against ISIS, which is Western Europeans plus Canada plus the United States and now tacitly also Russia, are all coming under threat. And they're going, I think there's two things that can happen. That can either cause the coalition to break apart or come together. And I'm with Scott. I think that what you are seeing is the coalition coming together as a result of this. So it is a game changer, probably not in the way ISIS was hoping.
Yeah, but if we have a situation where ISIS at the moment is the main target for the NATO nations, where do we put the fight against Assad in that? Because you mentioned the attempt by the French maybe to assassinate ISIS leadership.
Yeah.
Does this also raise the stakes on maybe an assassination attempt against Assad?
Well, I don't see an assassination attempt on Assad's life, but it does raise the larger issue that it's a very complex lay of the land. You know, the Turks up until now have been more concerned about the Kurds than they are about ISIS, and the Saudis and the Persian Gulf countries have been more concerned about Assad than they are about the Sunni militias. And so I think that this does put more pressure, particularly on the Turkish government, to be more forthcoming and working with ISIS. Now, or working with the coalition to deal with ISIS. Now, dealing with Assad is a whole other separate matter, and that's, again, where things get very, very complex very quickly.
In the last 6 weeks, Bruce, we have seen three spectacular attacks by ISIS. On October 10th, there were several suicide bombers who killed 95 people in Ankara, Turkey, as a result of Turkey's attacks, air attacks against ISIS. On the 31st of October, that's when ISIS downed the Russian plane. And then just 2 days ago, now we have a coordinated suicide attack in Paris. What we are witnessing is not a single attack here or a single attack there. What we are witnessing now is a pattern shift in ISIS behavior, a shift that they did not go through until 2 months ago, and it's largely because of the coalition's success. And I'm afraid that domestic politics in the United States, the fact that this has been under the radar, has been causing tremendous confusion, both the right and the left, that is, from Hillary Clinton all the way through Donald Trump. Nobody's paying attention to what's happening to ISIS on the ground. They are shrinking. As they shrink, they're lashing out like a cornered cat.
So they are more dangerous. They are more dangerous now, whereas they may be losing on the battlefield. But insofar as gaining recruits and gaining those that want to do devastation all over the world, far more dangerous than they were a year ago.
Exactly. To us here in the West, because they're losing in the region that they started out at.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8289 and Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. I gave the wrong number. Should not have done. The phones are not working tonight. Bruce Dumont at museum.tv or at Dumo. At DUMO. That's how you connect with us tonight.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, thank you very much for being with us. And I want to talk to you, Robert Pape, because you have mentioned that basically there has been a containment on the part of the White House. And the other day in the interview that the president did with George Stephanopoulos, he said that the United States was containing ISIS. Now, since the attack in Paris, everyone and their brother has been criticizing the president and making him look foolish for saying what he did. But basically, following up on what you have just said in this first segment of the show, the president was perhaps correct in stating that, but maybe didn't set it up properly?
That's what I think. I think President Obama was actually correct in the territorial sense that we have been containing and actually doing more than that, rolling back ISIS. ISIS today controls far less territory than it did 12 months before, in large part because of the coalition that President Obama put together and working with the Kurds and the Shia in the region. What that does not mean, however, is that the group is contained in the sense of attacking us. And what many people don't know, because they think the opposite, many people think, oh, if the group gets stronger in the region, then they'll come and get us. My research shows exactly the opposite, Bruce. It's that when groups are shrinking, that's when they tend to attack. Let me talk about the Chechen rebels. The Chechen rebels during the 1990s did a lot of terrorism, not a single attack on Moscow, didn't try to kill Russian civilians. They launched the deadly attacks on Moscow when Russia went in and shrunk the territory that the Chechen rebels controlled. The same thing with the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. They did attacks when they were losing ground, the ground they cared the most about. So that what we need to expect is as we roll back against the group, this pattern of them lashing out, I'm afraid, is quite likely to continue.
No, go ahead, Scott.
So, and this is really an important point because a lot of the narrative on the Sunday news shows was all about how the policy is not working.
Right.
And ironically, the policy is working,
right.
And that's what's leading to this shift in strategy. Because one of the things I was reading a lot about is this debate within the policy community about how do you explain the shift in strategy? Because up until now, they really have been focused on holding territory and building this Islamic caliphate this territory.
Scott, much of the policy community wants to say that we should look at the ideology of a group's doctrine and then figure out their targeting logic. If that were true, there'd never be a shift,
right?
And that's why they can't figure out the shift. It's because they're wrong that it's this religious doctrine dictating everything, as if what they're doing is going to Quran for the right verse to know who to target. That's not what's happening. What's happening is groups are varying their targeting, and I study every suicide attack over the last 30 years. So that's 4,500 by dozens of groups. So I can look at this in detail and see the shifts in their targeting patterns, and the shifts really correlate with losing ground.
Right. Predictable.
Let's talk about some of the suicide bombers. Now, what we know based on what has been revealed thus far is that there was someone with a Syrian passport. So it has raised the possibility, and because he came in to Greece, he was processed through Greece, and yet there is this fear that many in the world have, not just in the United States, that as we try to be compassionate and reach out to refugees, we are worried about in that group there are some people that want to do harm. Now we now have concrete evidence that was used in this terrorist attack. What is it going to mean for the future discussion and the future compassion for the United States and other nations of the world that want to help, but there's now here is Exhibit A. You better not do that.
I think we need to recognize that it is very reasonable that we should worry about ISIS moles coming through those refugees. They're not going to be large in number. So if we let in hundreds of thousands, I'm not saying we've let in hundreds of thousands of terrorists, but we should not at all be surprised that there are a handful, maybe even a few dozen moles that are in that mix.
When Ben Rhodes, one of the deputy national security advisors who was sent out today, he's more the political guy than really the policy guy. When he goes on all the shows today and says that, yes, the United States is still going to take that first wave of 10,000, supposedly some of them are already here in New Orleans, when he says that they're all going to be vetted, That's BS.
Well, first of all, two things. One is you have to realize that those refugees are the first victims of ISIS. You know, that wave of refugees are the people that are caught between the hammer of the Assad regime and the Islamist militants on the other hand. And they're fleeing the war. So in some respects, they're victims. They're victims of this war and they're victims of ISIS.
Well, what about the guy that got through?
Well, second of all,
he's faking that he's a victim.
Second of all, I would probably say, so one person came through on the, you know, with the Syrian passport, but the majority of those people were all, French citizens who, marginalized politically, socially, economically, living in the banlieue and the outskirts of Paris. And so there is that, that.
So you're saying let them in?
Well, what I'm saying is you can vet them.
How?
But second of all, first of all, there's a very real refugee crisis.
No question about it.
If you want to get rid of some of the impetus for radicalization, you can start dealing with this with the challenge of the refugee crisis. I mean, we're talking about letting in 10 million people, but there are 4 million displaced.
So, 10,000 people. I'm a professor at a university. I myself am liberal, and I am surrounded by many strong, good, smart liberals. Shortly after 9/11, when I did my first research on suicide terrorism and I saw what was causing it, my book called for, and I've had to say, we needed to tighten our immigration controls from Saudi Arabia, from other countries that we had militarily deployed troops in and that bin Laden was using to mobilize against us. That's a very difficult thing to call for in our country because we're an immigrant society. We want to believe we're a melting pot for the world. But I'm afraid the fact is that if it's military intervention that is driving it, as I'm suggesting, then where we're militarily intervening, we have to be very careful about letting people in, even if they look to be in need of compassion and even if they were our friends.
A suggestion was made, and I want to get everybody's reaction. A suggestion was made several weeks ago that what is needed is not only a no-fly zone, but also there has to be a zone where people, refugees, can go and be protected by this international force so they don't have to go to Greece. They don't have to go to France. They don't have to come to the United States. They are protected at some large area over there, whether it is in Jordan, whether it is in Saudi Arabia, and that's where it should be done. Does that make sense?
Well,
and how would that be imposed? Because the political pressure about refugees coming to the United States, it has to be 10 times more intense in France. And Germany, which had an open door policy up until about 3 months ago, they're now shutting the door because their it is a domestic security as well as a domestic political issue. There.
So
nobody wants these people now. And again, this Syrian who helped blow up the suicide bomber, he's only going to make the opposition strong and the efforts of nationalism all over Europe much stronger.
Right. Again, there are about 4 million displaced Syrians. The vast majority of them are in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. Right now, that's de facto kind of what's happening. One of the problems with that humanitarian crisis is there's very little money for them. They can't work. They're basically living in refugee camps. There are ways that we could, the U.S. could, and the international community could fund, provide aid for those refugee camps and provide ways for them to make money and basically
Saudi Arabia
de facto,
has a little extra money.
Right,
Saudi Arabia
right.
could
well,
kick in
but
for
de
a lot
facto,
of that.
They would that there is a way of addressing that humanitarian crisis there that would minimize the pressure on them going into.
But why
into
isn't
Europe.
It being done, or why isn't that being done as fast?
Lack of
as
political will.
I think it's
lack
because
of political
who?
Will
from who?
From the international community, from everybody.
So, Bruce, I don't know if you remember, but I was on your show a month ago, and this is exactly what I was suggesting we needed to do. We had the caller from Idaho.
Yes, we did.
Who was complaining about the Syrians coming
into
his community.
Didn't want them in Boise.
He didn't want them in Boise. And what we were talking about was exactly this idea. The problem is it's very expensive. And without a real security threat, you're not going to get Western publics to pay the money it's going to cost to really help the refugees in the region. I now think that they see that it's a good idea.
But again, they would argue that why is this a Western issue? Why is this not more of a Muslim issue? Why is it not an issue? One of the wealthiest nations in the world is Saudi Arabia.
Because
are they not playing?
Because
a stronger
we're going to have
role?
To spend if we wanted to even build a wall, which I don't think is a good idea. That's going to be fantastic. fantastically expensive. This is the better way to go, is to actually provide support for refugees in the region, as opposed to trying to pretend we're going to have an iron dome around the United States, which we'll never be able
Robert,
to.
Robert, because you are an expert on and you've written the definitive book in the history of the world on suicide bombing, and that's what we're talking about
Thank
now.
You.
We're talking about the suicide bombers. Supposedly one got away. Supposedly, they killed seven of them, but one got away.
Well, six killed themselves. The police killed one, and one appears to be on the loose.
But again, as bad as this circumstance has been, with 129 dead, 352 injured, the fact that someone had a ticket strapped with a bomb, who was going to go to in an 80,000 stadium. Mm-hmm. Soccer stadium where the president of France was watching the French-German exhibition game. The fact that he did not get in there, I mean, we should all thank God that he did not get in there.
Definitely
we would have been talking tens of thousands of
people. We should definitely thank God, and we should also notice that every bit of new information we learn shows how much planning, how much coordination went into these attacks. We just learned today that there are phone calls or there's communications between ISIS and the region and some of the attackers. This is very different than the kind of self-radicalized lone wolves that ISIS has been inspiring in the last year in the West. This is a different kettle of fish.
And it's not a JV team.
It's not a JV team, but it's because ISIS is now taking all the resources they were devoting to coordinated suicide attacks in Iraq and Syria, which much of the public wasn't paying attention to, and now they're applying that level of effort against us.
We got to pause. We're going to bring more guests in when we come back from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dubon.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight, we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Scott Hibbard is with us this evening. He is a professor from DePaul University. Also joining us from DePaul University is Mike Miller. And also joining us is State Senator William Delgado from Illinois State Senator. And again, Robert Pape also joins us from the University of Chicago and author of the book. You offered so many books.
But Bombing to Win, Dying to Win, and Cutting the Fuse.
And cutting,
one on air power, two on suicide terrorism.
Cutting the Fuse is the one on suicide
terrorism. Two on suicide terrorism. Dying to Win and Cutting the Fuse. And now I'm working another book on the targeting logic of suicide terrorist groups.
We do have, by the way, a tweet that's come in here. It said, disagree with your guest that the refugees are victims of the war. If most are able-bodied men, they ought to fight, not run. Something's not right about the way the thinking is going on. Your reaction to that? Some of these pictures that we see, these are not all starving children and women.
But the vast majority of them are just families and farmers trying to get out of harm's way. I mean, this happens anytime there's a war. You're caught between the militants on the one side and the regime on the other side, and the vast majority of people don't want any part of it.
In terms of data, I heard the same thing. It was families and so forth. But the only data I have seen says it is 80% young male. Especially going into Europe, it's 80% young male. When they show the picture, all children and
part of that is also because if they stay, they'll be impressed to fight on one side or the other.
I can understand, but is it really 80% young men?
I don't think that number's right at all.
So they
don't want to stay. Then let me ask the question. I'll use the C word. Are they cowards?
No.
These are people.
They don't want to die for the Assad regime, and they don't want to fight for ISIS or the Jabhat al-Nusra.
So they don't want to fight for what they believe in.
Well, you would assume that the Assad regime actually stands for anything aside for maintaining its power Or if you look at all the other groups, you know, it's not just ISIS, but the, you know, there are a number of other, you know, militant groups. But the, for the most part, they're dominated by, you know, jihadi elements. And
is it wrong to use the word coward, Bob? Because these are people, as you say, they're losing on the battlefield. But is it cowardly when you put a suicide vest? Granted, you're willing to die for your cause. But you're going in. You're not fighting someone that's got weapons. You're fighting someone that really is totally defensive. Aren't those cowards?
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, I think that we can always look at somebody and say, if I were in their shoes, I would have done it differently. And then, therefore, yes, you can use the word coward for that. But what I would say is that I think that we don't have a cohesive, moderate force in Syria. We don't have one also in Anbar. And so the choice, as Scott is saying, is a choice between two devils. So this isn't a choice where they're choosing, there's a good group to fight for, and they're cowards for not supporting that group. There is the Assad devil, and then there's the ISIS devil, and then there's this messy middle, which nobody yet has been able to step forward to organize. The thing is, it is true, it would be good if we had a major leadership figure among the moderates. That has not come. That is really the way to go, that would change things. But it is the case that you're right. If somebody here is looking at, well, I would do something differently, then they could be justified.
I want to bring Senator Delgado. Senator William Delgado is an Illinois state senator. He's very active in the Democratic Party. And again, I want to sort of bring the politics into this, because because when something like this happens, it's really unclear to know, at least at this moment, who politically in the United States, who wins and who loses because of this. But obviously we know we live in a country where the issue of immigration and illegal immigration is a very hot topic, more for Republicans than Democrats. But again, in a general election, it will be an issue that the Democrats will have to address in a much more broad way than they did in the debate last evening. So when you look at this issue on the issue of refugees and how we should treat people that look differently than us, I mean, you're the closest thing to a real live politician.
I don't know if that's a compliment or not.
It's meant to be a compliment.
I'm elected, yes.
It's meant to be a compliment because you are sensitive to the attitudes of people, and you have to deal with them. How are they reacting to stuff like this?
Well, first of all, this country has, you know, we're a country of immigrants, and we understand that psychology. I think it's embedded in us already as a psychology. Going back to a psychology of folks who are maybe a coward, or young men who are immigrants, who are refugees, and people who are really an accountant or a farmer, and all the chaos that's going on in the country already, and a population that may not be armed, and all of the rumor mill, we sensationalize everything around us, and let alone be known that men are being killed by ISIS, and let alone my little sister might be taken. These families are going to go ahead, and that's what you're seeing as general populations. No different in America, because as a former felony parole agent or a child welfare specialist in Miami, I wasn't concerned about the immigrant driving next to me going to work. I was more concerned about, you know, bombers or baby abusers or murderers on borders. It's the same concept. If we bring a Walter Podolchek from Russia and adopt him, or Ilyan from Cuba, we'll have a Mariel Boatlift. We have refugees who came here and did that. But we treat them differently depending on where they come from. This is a whole different situation from a Mexico or a Canada or a Poland versus a religion that people are maybe attacking or not attacking, and then and creating a moniker that's putting the baby out of the bathwater and saying all Muslims, like we have assistants in Springfield, they're Muslim, but they're American-born. So when we look at that psychology, we have to make sure, yeah, let's be careful with our immigration policy. I agree with academia. The same time, we still have to be a nation of leaders and making sure that we're caring for those law-abiding citizens in no matter what country. And that country hasn't had, I don't think, many folks are stopping at red lights. Mm-hmm. We're having a common community right now.
I want to get Mike Miller, you've listened to this discussion so far. It's been on your mind since the moment you heard the news.
Sure.
What perspective do you add to the discussion at the moment?
Well, I guess I come down with Bob that I'm a very big fan since undergrad and graduate school. In my PhD, I was in population economics. I've studied immigration. Legal immigration is a wonderful thing, as long as you know who the people are that are coming in, and we have every right to do that. And I just don't know how in the world we could ever know anything about these people, because there's no database in Syria. There's no database in the world that lets us know who these people are. And I think we have to err on the side of caution as opposed to err on the side of compassion.
That was the real strong comment today. Marco Rubio was on television today. And his response, now Ben Carson also said that he doesn't think that we should accept the refugees. The oddest response to the Paris situation was by Donald Trump, in which he said if they had had guns.
Oh, for God's sake.
I mean, to me, and people have heard me say that, you know, Donald Trump has said some absurd things. He's been able to overcome some of the absurd things that he said. But as someone who wants to be the leader of the United States and the free world, I think basically making a comment that I think was only intended for domestic political power or at least solicitation.
When we had an economic crisis and John McCain was running for president and he started to say truly erroneous, crazy things, mm-hmm. that's really what sunk McCain.
Just to respond to the immigration issue, whether or not we let in 10,000 Syrians is really not going to dramatically impact the humanitarian crisis to any great extent. But the humanitarian crisis is not going away.
No,
and this
I agree.
Is something that America really that needs to just demonstrate leadership on, whether that's getting money or providing some kind of assistance. But that's a huge issue, and it does drive extremism.
But I also think that it's a common sense response, like you were suggesting. There can be places in the world. There's enough geography over there where refugees could go that could be treated. And again, the nations of the world could contribute monetarily to creating a safe haven for them. It doesn't have to be in the respective countries, whether it's Germany or France or certainly the United States. And when we're in a domestic situation, I don't think it's absurd for Marco Rubio to say, as he did today, it's common sense. Where do you conduct a background check
right.
on someone who's coming in the country? Who do you call?
Yeah.
Who do you call, Scott?
Well, I think you can still vet people. I mean, we do this all the time.
We don't necessarily vet people coming across the southern border. How do you do it?
Yeah. You interview people.
We've had people on this program who've said this. My mind is open. How do you vet someone when you have thousands of people? How do you vet them? How do you check their background to find out that they are not a jihadist?
In the same way that we do that right now, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people do this every day for everybody coming from Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia, from Mexico, from Venezuela.
Professors, I would just offer this for a little debate here and give you maybe an example that hopefully it'll fit. And that would be, again, I was mentioning the Cuban Mariette crisis. If a country doesn't have a relationship with a country, and when Cuba had the Mario Botlif, if I was a parole agent in Miami, when it arrived to Miami, there's still 5,000 men that are in Louisiana prisons, and Castro has stamped his prisoners. With the lack of a relationship with the embassies or no embassies, those men are still there, and therefore we're not able to get vetted. So the food for thought, this is still a live case, and we still have Cubans that are in prison from the Mario Botlif because they have no identity, no relationships on who these individuals are. We were able to see some through our offices and then send some through once we were able to identify and verify they were professionals. So that's a live case here. A versus one would be a military one. You still have Guantanamo, and those are military people who you know, yet some of them have been released to other countries.
Right.
So you do have a live situation in America right now, and those are 5,000 Cubans with a lack of diplomatic relationship with a country. How do you vet?
You say, Bob, early in the program, you say this is not the last time we are going to be having this discussion.
So what my research has shown, and in the last few years I've done more than the books I published in the past. So I've worked with a research team to study hundreds of spectacular attacks, the kind of attacks like we just saw in Paris, like we saw in Madrid, like we saw in London, like we saw in Moscow, Colombo, Tel Aviv. And what's really quite striking is when groups are losing territory, they are looking for a game changer.
I've got to pause. We've got to talk about that. We've got to break. But when we come back, again, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv or at Dumo is the tweet. The calls are not working tonight. I'm sorry.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time.
Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
Excuse me, Chad. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Robert Papel, let me ask you, you say that there will be other incidents like this. Because of the reaction that the French have had, and now they have retaliated because of the with the airstrikes today, do you expect the next attacks to continue to be in France, or does ISIS want to show their reach by going into London and going into other
ISIS
regions?
ISIS has, in the last 6 weeks, ISIS, and they had done this before, but they have now made even more pointed threats to the United States, to Britain. Basically, they're focusing on the largest military powers who are going against them. And that's very similar to what happened when we went into Afghanistan in the fall of 2001. We now know that when we went into Afghanistan in 2001, Al-Qaeda was on the run, but they had a meeting in December 2001 in Pakistan. That's when they decided to plan for Madrid, for the Bali bombing, for a number of the attacks that occurred over the next 3 years. They were planned by the Al-Qaeda leadership, and then the Al-Qaeda leadership basically decentralized those attacks as they were on the move. And that's why those attacks tended to stop after 2005, because they were all kind of like bullets in the chamber.
Where does Germany and Italy, again, two popular places where U.S. citizens travel and visit, where do they rank in your view?
They are lower. They are likely lower. It's a little. We have to be careful because at this point, I suspect ISIS is thinking of Western Europe. But within that, I think the countries that are most at risk are going to be France, Britain, and then also the United States and Russia.
If I can chime in on that, I want to pick up on something that Bob made, a comment he made earlier. This is not new. There have been a lot of bombings in Beirut, in Baghdad, and there's been almost daily bombings or daily attacks in Iraq.
There have been
400
suicide attacks. So I track every suicide attack around the world. Just in Iraq and Syria since 2013, over 400 confirmed suicide attacks, many of them multiple aim points, sophisticated, complex attacks. What we're seeing is a pattern that has existed for several years in Iraq and Syria is now being transported over to, first it was Turkey, now we see a sophisticated attack bringing down the Russian plane, and then now it's a coordinated attack in Paris.
Now, there are two points I wanted to make about that. One is that it's really the frontline states that are going to be facing the brunt of this, you know. The second thing is it's going to be, you know, there may be attacks in other places, but it's much more difficult for ISIS to operate in Western Europe than it is to operate in Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
Because you speak the language, you blend with the population, you can carry out suicide attacks in a way that you can't elsewhere, or just at least it's much, much, much more difficult. So, you know,
but if you're having foreign fighters coming back to your own country.
But we'll be, you know, the West will be obsessing about what's going to happen next in Western Europe. But we need to keep this in perspective that the region is really on the front lines.
Another issue that's likely to come back up is going to be things like the Patriot Act. So you might remember we've rolled back things like domestic surveillance and so forth because we've started to privilege more civil liberties. In order to really deal with the ISIS communication into France, you're going to need not only international communications that are available for security forces to look at, but they're going to need more ability to track and to follow up domestic communication.
But in this,
and that issue is going to be one that is, it was, we thought we had kind of, we, you know, the war and this was all over. I'm afraid the more we have learned about what ISIS has done with this coordinated attack, coordinated attacks are coordinated because of communication over multiple weeks.
But also in this particular case, there was no advance significant chatter. And the fear is they're using new encryption devices.
Right.
So they have become more sophisticated. And the question is, can we keep up with their sophistication?
Because
chatter, because this caught a lot of people flat-footed when it shouldn't.
Well, first of all, notice that we're finding evidence after the fact. And what happens is we vacuum up an enormous amount of information, which we then, after the fact, can go back in and piece together. I suspect we're going to not have to guess about how ISIS communicated with people. We're going to know quite a bit about that. And you're right, there's more sophisticated means that are there, but they are still basically just above amateurs. These are not black belts. These are not the CIA and the FBI. They have not had years of dedicated training. They're really just dedicating months and weeks, day after day, to do this mission, not just picking up a gun.
Is there going to have to be more cooperation between the NATO countries and sharing of information even with the Russians?
Well, there should be, yes. So give you an example. We found out when the Malaysian airliner disappeared that most countries around the world, although they have your passport information, don't check it against the Interpol database until after a plane disappears.
Right.
The United States checks, Britain checks, and the UAE. I don't know why they do. But almost all the other countries in the world, for over half of all international flights, don't check. And that's true to this day. This is one of the gaps in airport security which has occurred. And why? Because it costs money. You might have to delay a flight. And heaven forbid you find somebody who has a fake passport. Now you've got to go and arrest them.
Absolutely.
What are you
right.
going to do about that
right.
problem?
Right.
So much easier to stick your head in the sand unless we now have a real threat. And I think that unfortunately...
See, that's why I don't believe there is significant, serious vetting of refugees coming into the countries, because they're not even doing a significant job of checking passenger lists. They're not checking the backgrounds of the people that work on planes. And I think it's common sense. It's just we cannot know as much as we need to know.
Can I just say
this
one other thing about Sharm
el-Sheikh? You've got 10 seconds to go.
The fact that ISIS likely bribed somebody at Sharm el-Sheikh should really be a cause of concern, because that's an easy thing to do.
We've got to say farewell. You've got to go to another appointment. So, Bob, we're going to say Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, we say farewell to you. The rest of the group will be back. And when we come back, we'll be adding a new guest and we'll be expanding our discussion of the politics of this tragedy and also the politics of the Democratic nomination for president. Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time.
Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, featuring injections of room and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Scott Hibbard, Grant Culp, William Delgado, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base. And again, we're sorry to say that the phones aren't working tonight, but again, the emails are at brucedumont@museum.tv, or if you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And we've been talking about the tragedy in Paris. And, of course, France has already reacted with airstrikes. We had a lot of great information to share with you in hour number one. But now we're going to kind of broaden the base and talk about sort of the politics of it, the domestic politics, and also look a little bit at the Democratic debate that took place last night in Iowa, where Hillary Clinton and Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders all got together. And I'm going to offer an assessment and get everybody's reaction. I thought that last night was the first time in the campaign that I thought Martin O'Malley stepped up and made himself known, disagreed with Hillary Clinton, I think, on some significant issues, the most important being that he thought the United States really should be in a leadership role in taking on ISIS. Hillary Clinton said that she thought it shouldn't be led by Americans, and I thought that's probably a significant debate. And I thought that she said some things last night that, frankly, will come back to haunt her in a general election campaign. Grant Culp joins us, making his maiden voyage. He is a Republican and has been an advisor to a lot of Republicans over the years. Grant, what was your take of the debate and sort of your reaction to my assessment thus far?
No, I agree with your assessment. I do think that Martin O'Malley did kind of distinguish himself a little bit. And then during when Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders were talking about raising the minimum wage, he was able to kind of break in and get more on his results side that he's been able to do when they raise it in Maryland. Mm-hmm. So he was able to kind of go from just theory to actually results. And I think that kind of might resonate with a lot of Democrat voters where he's a little bit more, he has some substance other than just talk that they kind of had. That was
my Scott Hibbard, your reaction.
So I didn't watch the whole debate, just saw clips of it. I've always been a fan of Martin O'Malley. I did my doctorate in Baltimore, so I've known him for a while. It's still kind of a Hillary and Sanders show. And I thought it was, their exchanges were all good. You're beginning to see the differences between the candidates. Going back to your one line, though, I did think it was curious that she said it can't be an American fight. And I know what she was driving at. I would have phrased it differently.
Yeah.
I think what she was trying to say is, you know, we can't lead this fight. We can demonstrate leadership, but at the end of the day, it's got to be regional actors that resolve this problem. And just to kind of put it into context, it's not just this, you know, the fight with ISIS. And it's not just the Syrian civil war. There is a larger geopolitical context. There's a civil war or a proxy war going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So you really need, you know, all the players engaged. And I think that at the end of the day, that's kind of what she was driving at. I'm not sure she articulated it as well as she could have.
No, she missed the ball a couple of times.
Yeah,
Mike Miller, your reaction.
One was she apparently made some line regarding, I saw it this morning, and regarding the Wall Street. And she brought up 9/11 as some kind of justification for her taking money from Wall Street, which was a very strange thing. I never understood. But also when pressed, and I happen to agree with her view that it's not our battle only. Scott's description is excellent. But at the same time, from what I was able to see, she still cannot, just the same as Obama cannot, in any way pin this on a radical Islam problem. Nobody I have ever spoken to thinks for a second that all Muslims are a problem, that all of Islam is a problem. It is the radical Muslims that are the problem. And they simply will not admit that. And I think until they do admit that, they're missing what is underpinning many of the decisions and what is driving many of the decisions of
Senator Delgado, your reaction.
Yeah,
You're one of our Democrats, card-carrying Democrats today.
Well, absolutely. And knowing a couple of the members also and agreeing in terms of the governor, former governor of Maryland and former mayor, and understanding that sometimes really are the most substantive in terms of understanding. In my good friend Hillary's position, and we were here a few years ago and taking positions for her when there was other players on the stage. But when you're talking about Americans, the exhaustion of the Americans in terms of war, in terms of what America constantly always seems to have to be in the leadership roles, well, because we're the most powerful nation equipped in the world in terms of taking that. So something you want to be careful with trying to pacify too many listeners, and at the same time, she's absolutely right. It has to be in a coalition. I mean, that's what the United Nations is supposed to be for.
But by the way, one of the other things that I really liked last night about Martin O'Malley, and again, I don't think he's going to go very far, but one thing I really congratulated him on was bringing up the story about the person that said to him, please don't use the term boots on the ground. These are real live people.
Yeah.
And I think that hopefully that's a term that can fade away as the campaign goes forward. But again, don't we need more candid conversations by everyone that we can't win this without putting people on troops on the ground? They're going to have to fight. If this is going to be potentially the World War III, and this is an ideology that we're fighting, you can't do it from 30,000 feet. And so Lindsey Graham is the only one that's going out there and being that vociferous. He said 10,000 troops would do it. I don't think 10,000 troops necessarily would do it. But, I mean, Grant, don't Republicans and Democrats have to start dealing more honestly with voters?
I think they are realizing that, and I just think they're trying to find the right way to articulate how they can get the boots on the ground strategy and what we need to do over there. And I think the candidate that can articulate that the best, the quickest, will be able to see some jump in the polls and get a trust with some voters.
The guy that's been doing is Lindsey Graham, but he's an afterthought.
And this is kind of getting back to the earlier comment about radical Islam, is that the ideology is not that dissimilar from the ideology of promoted by some of our key allies like Saudi Arabia Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem, the reason why people are so careful about the language is what we're really concerned about are militant groups.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they're informed by an ideology.
Yes.
But the point is, when you start talking about, you know, we're at war with radical Islam, well, geez, you know, boy, that opens a Pandora's box. Because the way in which it's that language is used within the American public discourse over the last 10 years has been to promote a, you know, Islamophobic narrative in this country. And
I reject that. I reject that somehow Americans, because we would say that radical Islam is the problem, that somehow we then make that leap to hating or despising all Muslims. There's no Islamophobia.
In the aftermath of 9/11, there were a lot of commentators that they would make a distinction between radical Islam and Muslims, but then the more they started talking, you saw that distinction disappear.
No, but last night, and by the way, I thought that the moderator last night was the best moderator in any debate so far, but with one exception. He brought up Marco Rubio's comments about radical Islam. He tried to pin everybody down on whether or not they would use that term. Everyone backed away. Mm-hmm. And then he let Hillary say, well, you know, we're not against all Muslims.
No.
Marco Rubio didn't say that we're against all Muslims. I mean, the point is that he let all of the candidates sort of wiggle away, you know, from that statement, suggesting that this was just part of an anti-Muslim attitude, and that's not the case.
Well,
Islam should be easy. You will know it when you hear it, and you will know it when it is uttered. It seems to me that that's obvious.
Well, again, this is where, within the policy community and within the academic community, we make distinctions between jihadi militant groups and an ideology and an Islamist ideology. And it differs over between the distinction between the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS.
We got to pause. Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amling's now at 888-880-TREE. We have an email comment from David. He writes, with regard to Trump's comments about guns, perhaps he was referring to the concert hall where things might have turned out differently had there been armed guards present. I assume there were no armed guards there, and there weren't any armed guards there. So,
I guess it could be the concealed carry as well, that if there were a few people with concealed carry at that concert, that somebody could have opened up and shot these two. But, of course, they would have blown up the vest anyhow. A lot of people died.
Right.
Not to minimize it, but I just think that that's an odd thing to bring up at this point in terms of this particular event.
Right. In fact, I was really surprised because when I first heard the news, my immediate reaction was Donald Trump is going to jump on this. Mm-hmm. He's going to talk about the refugee issues. He's going to bring up his pet issues again.
Yeah.
And then when I read what he said, I said, this made no sense. Ben Carson was the first one to talk about the refugees. Mm-hmm. And then Marco Rubio came back and said, instantly that, you know, that we couldn't have to take any more refugees in, which seems to be a common sense response to it.
Yeah, see, I'm not a Trump supporter. I'm nothing against him. I'm not a supporter. But this is if I had any fear of a particular candidate, this is what I fear in him. He has these weird knee-jerk reactions which come out of nowhere, and I would wonder what he would do if he were in the Oval Office make decisions. I don't know.
I think this is the problem, right? I mean, both he and Ben Carson as outsiders are.
Is this going to really be a death knell to some of the outsider perspective that this, the fact that you maybe need a little more experience on the world stage?
You know, I think it could, but also, you know, when Trump made those comments, I wasn't surprised by it anymore. I mean, I'm not surprised by what he says anymore.
He's
really kind of built that level with folks. So I'm not surprised he made those comments, especially when he did in as quick as he did.
The one thing that I think the tragedy in Paris somewhat, I think, it overshadowed, I think, probably the lowest point of the campaign. With Donald Trump and this 95-minute speech in Iowa in which he talked about the people of Iowa, how stupid they were to believe, and then reenacting the episode in Ben Carson's life where he allegedly stabbed somebody, the knife incident, going on and on and on about it, and then talking about the pathological aspects of Ben Carson and drawing a comparison to a child molester. I mean, this was... I mean, I have often thought, and you've heard me say, I think that Donald Trump, you know, may have gotten in this race almost as a conspiracy to help, you know, Hillary Clinton. And I still,
and this is evidence of your theory.
Well, I'm just saying is that To me, it's almost that was 95 minutes of some of the most self-destructive things that anybody. So now I'm beginning to think maybe he really doesn't want to. When he's worried and he's now going to go out and say outrageous things. And again, that literally was lost. I mean, most people may not even know what I'm talking about right now. But go back and read the story or look at the speech that he gave last Thursday. I mean, you
the whole
talk
speech
about
is posted online on YouTube. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's a candidate that's as off the wall as he is.
Yeah.
And I'm beginning to think that maybe I should take him off my list of someone that could actually get elected.
Yeah, I did hear you say that only three people might possibly be president. He was one of the three.
He was one of the three, along with Marco Rubio and Hillary Clinton. Yeah. I think those are the only three.
I hope that you're wrong, but
Grant.
What makes me wonder is how do you prepare for a speech like that when you're just going all over the place like he did?
Yeah.
What goes through?
Does he
just get up there and start talking? But how do you, plan to go out and talk like that? I just don't.
One would hope that you'd be preparing your comments before you get up and say them, which it doesn't seem like he, like
and
he did.
And the other thing the reason why I said why it's almost a deliberate self-destructive situation is that he has argued, and I have believed him, that maybe he doesn't have to have specifics now, because if he was elected president, he would surround himself with smart people, which I think historically he has done. And I think that he would be able to do that. And because he's smart, he should be able to be a quick study. He could have gone in so many different directions in the wake of Paris, but to go the route that he went, it seemed to me that he was only interested in sort of reaching out to sort of the NRA folks who believe that the answer to every question is more guns, whether it's concealed carry. And in this particular case, again, you're talking about a city with maximum gun control. They don't have guns in Paris.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to say that was the response to a concerted attack involving ISIS, he missed an incredible opportunity, and I think showed himself to be a guy who doesn't have the temperament to be the president of the United States.
And also, Norman Lear was just recently on a recent talk show I've seen on cable, a popular one coming up, and Adam and Norman Lear, of course, created the Archie Bunker character.
Yeah.
And many people that I've come in touch with have said that's exactly what we have running for the president from Trump. And that's an Archie Bunker.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, he just seems to wants to be this American, but yet at the end of the day, criticizes everything else.
Yeah.
Everything is fair game for this man. With all the reason, because Bernie Sanders, being a Democrat and someone who I have a lot of positions that I would share with, but also has a very strong position on guns, being one who has NRA, and very Vermont being one of those types of states. And at the end of the day, this is not that kind of subject you would do. So on the level of delivering substance.
Bernie Sanders the other night, again, clearly he was a Johnny One Note on going after Wall Street. And I agree with you, Mike. I mean, her comment of tying, Wall Street and her, 9/11. I mean, I thought I was listening to Rudy Giuliani.
Yes,
I mean, it made no sense. It was one of the oddest responses. I mean, she's going to spend a lot of time on defense on that comment.
You just, took my next sentence. I think what you'll see out of the Hillary Clinton campaign and their surrogates this next week will be defending those statements, backtracking them, or having to explain them further.
Yes.
Because it was like, just like Mike said, I mean, I was totally, very confused. It was a head scratcher.
Right.
If we can go back to kind of your earlier question about is this the death knell for the outsiders? Because I think that's a really important question. So I think the injection of national security front and center into this campaign will change the tenor. And I think it really plays to Marco Rubio's campaign. I think it will play – I think it'll help Hillary Clinton a lot. I mean, because she's Secretary of State and she has a depth of knowledge on these issues that the other two candidates in the Democratic primary scene don't have. I think it'll help her. And I think
Does it help her with – The fact that her experience is as Secretary of State, and there's a lot of people. You may not be one of them, but again, the record of this administration around the world is not very impressive.
Well, as Bob Pape was highlighting, it's actually much better than people give it credit for. I mean, one of the reasons why,
in a campaign, can you explain it? I mean, I agree with what Bob said, but is that took a long time to tell the story.
And you need
he
the
makes
30
the case.
Sound.
So,
yeah.
I think there's a shaping taking place, as you're pointing out. A shaping taking place. I think I'm picking up on me. Marco Rubio starts talking to the national front. Hillary starts taking the national front. these issues are starting to shape and fine-tune where we should be going as a country.
And you were making a point that's this immigration issue that we have in this country. We know that it's going on in Western Europe. We know that, you know, the open arms that Angela Merkel had initially, you know, she's had to backtrack because there are people saying you're taking too many. It certainly isn't. It's going to go in the opposite direction in France and around the world. But it's also happening in South America. You were telling this story about what's happening in...
Absolutely, in Colombia and Venezuela. Yeah. And Venezuela with the oil crisis and a lot of... This is a major country with empty stores. And we have many friends who are there, right? Here in the city of Chicago and the consuls, and yet they're pushing the 40-year homeowners of Colombia live on the border out. You come home from work and there's a D on your home, says demolition. Come home, your home's torn down.
Right.
But that happened right here in America, and Trump, by the way, had some of this wrong, but in the 1930s under the Hoover administration, they wanted to help an economy, and they pushed 1.2 million Mexicans who were born in the United States with U.S.-born certificates, birth certificates, into Mexico, many who had never even been there, and they want to get real jobs for real Americans.
Right.
And so we know that there's definitely an immigration that's always been. In 1965, under the Civil Rights Act, they opened up the Immigration Act here to be able to help the Cesar Chavez's of the world, because when he had four European nations they would let come into this country, which was the France and the artist types, and they had to do that to be able to let Mexico and other countries come in. So under the Civil Rights Act, they actually did something really huge, and they amplified and opened up the Immigration Naturalization Act to allow other nations
to migrate.
But again,
your point about what the president of Venezuela is doing. The president of Venezuela is basically doing what Donald Trump says he's going to do.
Not building
a wall, but you're right, putting a D on their houses to be destroyed.
Yes, and we don't see this on your Channel 7s here. I have to watch it on my international package. I tell the Broadcast Association that every year. So at the same time, in Haiti, we have in Dominican Republic, the Dominicans are doing that, and the Haitians standing in line trying to, and Senator Kwame Raoul and myself have a resolution supporting the Haitian government as we're meeting here, and that is that you have Dominicans saying you're in an immigration line, and they're both black of color, so the officials coming out saying, who is the Dominicans in line? Haitians get in the bag, so they're kicking them out, and a lot of this has to do with territory and jobs and lack of resources. So it's a different purpose, but in that war zone areas over there. So in Venezuela, they had a whole cumbre, which is a big old conference in Panama, and now the two presidents have come together, and they're going to try to simmer. My legislative assistant is from Colombia, Barranquilla, and she lives in Springfield, married to a nice guy here, has been here 4 years, and is going to have a baby soon, and she's a U.S. citizen, and this is happening in her country, and they're cousins and friends.
Well, the issue is, as it comes to a fore here, I mean, in your view, I want to get reaction to this, aren't the Democrats going to have to address the issue of immigration in a different way than they're dealing with it right now? They're not going to go as far as the Republicans.
No.
But Hillary even alluded to it the other day somewhat.
Yeah, but you also, again, being an economist, I'm a data guy, so we look at lots of data. A vast majority of the people who are here illegally are because of visa overstays.
Yeah.
It's not coming across the border in Mexico, although that is part of the issue.
It's also we can't hire them fast enough.
Well,
I mean, there's a huge magnet pulling
folks,
people.
We have to pause. I'm Bruce Dumont. BruceDumont at museum.tv is the email. At Dumo is the tweet. Again, phone's not working tonight. Sorry about that. Back shortly.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We have another email comment that's come in here from Bernard listening in New York. He said this gets back to the first discussion that we had this evening, which Robert Paper from the University of Chicago was saying that because ISIS is on the run and losing on the battlefield in their neck of the woods, they are really unleashing these external terrorist attacks around the world, including obviously what happened in Paris last week. And he said that it was a sign that maybe the battle that the United States and the West was taking to ISIS was having some battlefield successes. He said, is lashing out, this is what Bernard writes, is lashing out when shrinking really true? Was Nazi Germany's shrinking in September of 1939 when they hit Poland, in 1940 when they hit France? End of comment. Professor Hibbert?
Well, this is where Robert Pape should probably be here to defend himself. But if you remember this example, he was talking about the Chechen War. Mm-hmm. When the Russians were making gains on Grozny, the Chechen rebels took the fight to Moscow, mm-hmm. and one could argue that this happened in Algeria in the 1990s when the armed Islamic group was being defeated by the Algerian regime. They started in the Algerian regime was backed by the French. They started planting bombs in Paris in summer 1995.
Mm-hmm.
So there are examples or other examples of this.
Grant, you are the youngest member of our panel tonight, so I'm going to ask you to kind of speak for an entire generation. When I was watching the reaction from Paris today, I got the impression that Paris is a city that, my generation and for generations, Paris was a city where you went and you had fun, and the vibrancy of Paris was really, it was one of the most lively cities in the world, and obviously was a place that has a great lure for young people. For all its history, but certainly in the last 100 years, Paris was where you would go when you were young, and it was carefree, and there was just a whole lifestyle that emerged from going to Paris. But with what happened the other day, it would seem to me that your generation and the generation that's growing up today, you're not going to be able to have the carefree lifestyle of going to Paris or going anywhere because of this fear of terrorism. And I want to get a sense from you whether your generation is aware of the fact that maybe you are not going to have the same freedoms that my generation had and Mike Miller and everybody around the table had, that you're going to be far more, whereas you're living in a different world. Are you understanding that maybe you aren't going to have the freedoms that previous generations had?
I think we will, but I think it's a different awareness. I mean, a lot of the folks in my generation remember sitting in the classrooms on September 11th all day long watching, footage from New York. So, I mean, I think there is that awareness of terrorism that it's everywhere and witnessing it. But I think, it's not going to take people's interest away from either going to Paris at all. I mean, I don't think people are going to stop traveling. It's just they know that terrorism is out there, but it's not going to. I don't think it's going to stop travel. I mean, maybe short term, like we did see after the 9/11 attacks, but people are still going to go to the City of Lights.
But is it? But is it also one of the stories again on CNN this afternoon was that the fact that many of the focus of these attacks. They were in young, vibrant neighborhoods. That they is. Were rock mm-hmm. concerts. They were soccer. They were young people out and engaging in everyday life in Paris. And yet they became so vulnerable. And also they tended to be of a political philosophy where, diversity, that they embraced diversity. It was a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether generation now is going to think twice about the inclusiveness of their lifestyle.
Right, and this is something that I really do worry about. We were talking about this earlier off air, but one of my great fears is the death of cosmopolitanism, that mm-hmm. of that idea that we really are a melting pot.
Right.
And I was in Paris 2 years ago, And it was great. I'm buying crepes from a Tunisian, you know, guy who's, you know, speaking to me in Arabic as he's like, you know, making, you know, cooking up the crepe. And to me, that's, you know, that's the essence of Paris today. And I think is I don't want to overplay this, because I think that at the end of the day, there's short term costs. I mean, people will be, you know, the National Front people will be, you know, playing the stuff up. But I think, you know, it will return. I mean, Paris does have that, you know, indomitable spirit.
And that vibration must occur. And I appreciate your comments, Grant, also. And I was just thinking about that as, again, and I've not been there, and understanding internationalism and what I love the most. And a young lady, I guess, was from Cal State, Noemi Hernandez, Latina, I understand. And then the Puerto Rican, I listened to that for my mother and for a district I represent in Puerto Rico's news, interviewing a young lady that lives right down the street from one of the places that got bombed.
Mm-hmm.
And she's Puerto Rican, studying there and living there in Paris. And people think this little island with 3.5 million people, this affects us all. And the sad part is, you know, like we talk about our the religions, we want to care about. We don't care who you come, where you come from. Have morals, have dignity, and show love for one another. That's what these young generations are doing. And that's what Paris represented to us, like San Juan and the Viejo San Juan.
Senator, I want to ask you a question. I want to ask you to comment on Republican politics. You're a Democrat.
Sure.
You want Hillary Clinton to be the next president of the United States. And we've talked about in the past whether or not, I mean, we have a unique situation in the Republican Party now, where two of those left standing, and maybe two of those that will be left standing, you know, 3 months from now, are both Cuban Americans.
Yep.
Ted Cruz, more the outside guy, and Rubio emerging as the establishment, one of the establishment candidates. Would there be appeal for Puerto Ricans to support a Hispanic who could be the next president of the United States, or is the battle for and the competition between Puerto Ricans and Mexicans and Cubans, is it so great that you would rather not have?
I appreciate that
you'd rather not have a Cuban, because a lot of Puerto Ricans don't like Cubans.
No, I think that comes again from someone else saying that, suggesting that reality, because that's not my reality. It's not reality of a lot of people. First, the Latinos as a group, a homogeneous group of different countries, are pretty conservative if you think about it. Now, at the end of the day, this isn't about being prejudiced or racism against a Marco Rubio because he's Cuban. I lived in Hialeah. I lived in Florida. I worked in that state as a child welfare.
Right.
I understand the Cuban community helped me speak better Spanish even. As a U.S.-born Puerto Rican,
has to
do with his policies, has to do with the principles and the precepts and what he represents for socioeconomic realities, for small businesses, large businesses, for tax structures, for the rich versus the middle class, has to do with what's your goal with life. If you believe in pro-life, then let's also care about him when you have autism. Let's not just say, oh, pro-life, and then you're on your own. So when you have certain conditions, that's going to define you. So we don't care about the color of your skin. We want the continuity of character. Unfortunately, the Republican field has a large deficit. Mr. Rubio, I believe, is not ready for the international stage and the national stage right now. What I agree or disagree with him, and the state of Florida being a right-to-work state, which I worked as a state person and at a small business, by the way, and being pretty radical on children issues and the ability to expand and unionize and grow your own land. Because if you can grow a party, you can grow a union. I have no problem with the
nationality. I want to come back to the and again, maybe this is not as a professional politician.
Mm-hmm.
Those
populations.
Maybe it is difficult for you to answer the question, but my question. So right. I'm going to ask it a different.
Sure.
I'm going to try to ask it a different way.
Sure.
There was certainly African American pride or Black pride when Barack Obama ran.
Mm-hmm.
People were inspired because they liked the idea of one of their own aspiring to be the president of the United States. Absent the fact of a national Hispanic leader who people are seriously considering at the national level in the Democratic Party,
yes,
where Hispanics have been very loyal,
yes,
that's not likely to happen in the foreseeable future. You have, on the Republican side, you have the potential. Most people would say, many people would say, that Marco Rubio at this moment may have a real good opportunity to be president of the United States. And would there be Hispanics, even though
absolutely.
Would prefer that the first Hispanic was a Puerto Rican, in mm-hmm. your case, mm-hmm. or someone who's listening say, I wish the first Hispanic was Mexican. The first Hispanic might be Cuban, mm-hmm. and would there be mm-hmm. sufficient pride to say we would really be proud that someone who came from his background.
I think the plurality of the Latino voting, the plurality of the Latino voting in the United States of America is still highly Democratic, Democrats, and the I-4 corridor between Tampa and Orlando is heavily Puerto Rican right now, for the exodus of Puerto Rico. And then Lake Dade County is Cuban and Nicaraguan now, because little Havana is Nicaraguan. In terms of what they do, in terms of the, and so we have Republicans who left Puerto Rico, they live in Orlando. You're going to have a percentage, 23%. Mr. Bush proved that with getting a large Latino vote there. A lot of it, we're going to have our Archie Bunkers that are going to do the same thing. They're going to vote when they get in that urn, and they're going to vote for that person who's Latino, just like in any of our populations. We have that in all. But generally speaking, we're pretty much a Democratic population, and we're seeing some shifts in the Southwest, being a member of the National Hispanic Council, like in Arizona, in Texas, for generations.
The Puerto Rican influx into Florida is
huge.
Is making it is huge, and it's making it more of a tougher state for Republicans to win.
Yes, Democratic was stronger than I-4 corridor.
It isn't just the Cubans that swing that state.
Well, we're finding, exactly, very true. However, we're finding in Orlando and the area of the metropolitan of the Orlando area there, we are getting a Darren Soto, who is a very moderate type, going as a state senator. I think I helped. But, you know, he sits on almost both sides of the aisle. I do a lot of good work on both sides of the aisle. Some of you listening will tell you that.
We got to pause. 1-800, I'm sorry, I'm not giving the phone number. Back to you.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amling's now at 888-880-TREE.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Grant Culp is one of our Republicans this evening. Grant, we talked briefly about Donald Trump, a little bit about Carson, but as you look at the rest of the field right now with 78 days to go before Iowa, where do you see the battle for the nomination going, and do you feel that Jeb Bush still has an opportunity to get back in this race?
I think he does, given his executive experience, and I think with what happened in Paris, we'll now put more Homeland Security back is maybe number one issue, and where you have folks that served in executive branch and kind of work with Homeland Security, law enforcement, these folks will be able to talk up their backgrounds in that. And I think you could see Chris Christie, coming back up, maybe making it back to the big boy debate, given his work in New Jersey, and where you go to folks like Carson, Trump, and Carly Fiorina, who really haven't had any Homeland or defense experience before, other than just sitting in a green room with Putin before. These folks have actually have a background on it. So I think we'll see a big
Mike,
see a
where, do you, shift. Where do you see the rest of the
Yeah,
the group?
I think Bush still has a chance. His biggest enemy is himself. He doesn't seem that – he doesn't interview well. He doesn't speak well. I was on with you one time, and you said that he was at the Chicago club or some club, and he gave a talk, and it was just a terrible, terrible talk. And so he's his biggest enemy. And the guy that I'm a big fan of is John Kasich, but he came across as a scold. I think he was actually right almost every time he scolded the people, but he comes across bad. His personality doesn't doesn't.
He's always been like that too. Remember when he was in Congress, but I always thought that he was going to be the guy that really came on strong.
I'm still hoping.
Yeah. He's smart and he's you know, he's been able to win in a blue state, and
he has administrative experience. He's been in Congress. He is. If you worry about there being too conservative of a Republican, he's not that. Yeah. He's a moderate Republican. And I thought that he and Rubio would be an unbeatable pair.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but somehow my Republican colleagues won't listen to me. It drives me nuts, Bruce. It does.
I've shared my same assessment on the show, and it's not happening. We can wish it, but it's not happening. The other thing I would say that just to pick up on what Grant just said is, I think the one guy, and again, I have said that I don't think he can be elected, and I really don't, and I'm not even sure he can be nominated. But again, I would say that the undercard the other day, I thought one of the best guys of the whole night was Chris Christie. Mm-hmm. Chris Christie was on target with Hillary Clinton. He's also responded, I think, very positively in the wake of what happened in Paris. I think he could be emerging as a guy, as Donald Trump continues to self-destruct, in my view. Maybe New Hampshire is a place where Christie could make a comeback because he's spending a lot of time there.
There was that interview this morning. I watched the Talking Head shows, and they interviewed Carson. And they essentially asked him straight away, what would you do if you were the president this morning or the day afterwards? Yeah. I thought it was a terrible answer. I've been a department chairman. That's not exactly a manager. But I would have come up with something about I would bring together these people and we would get this advice and we would begin getting these things.
He couldn't even answer who he would call first.
I know. I was so frustrated because he's such a fine man, has a great story. I just don't think he's ready to be president. And he proved it to me today that he could not, when put on the – and he had to know this was coming – put on the spot, he could not say in a managerial sense – I would do X, Y, Z, and so forth to show me he could manage, and he can't, and that bothers me.
He's a great pediatric neural surgeon.
Yeah.
He's not ready.
And the other point is that you have a situation where, and this is extremely frustrating, is that when Donald Trump the other day, again, this was the speech that everybody should take a look at, if you're still for Donald Trump, when he said, to the people of Iowa, how can you be so stupid?
Yes.
How can you be so stupid to fall for Ben Carson's line? And you know what? I would ask that question tonight to everyone who's listening and watching who's for Donald Trump. How could you be, and I'm going to say it, okay? Maybe you'll tweet against me tomorrow. How can you be so stupid to believe that at this moment in world history, with all that's going on, that Donald Trump and his big mouth is really who you want to be the commander in chief and to give the keys to the kingdom to? How could you be so stupid with everything else? There are other opportunities. If you want someone from the outside, there are other options. Ted Cruz is an option. Ted Cruz would be an option.
Yeah,
he is every bit as outside as Donald Trump. Only I think he's got some smarts and at least.
That's brilliant.
Knows what to do, and so I'll probably get a lot of grief from that. I'm just saying, and I haven't completely taken him off my list, but I'd like to think that I have enough confidence in the American people that they would not throw their vote away.
I just got a comment on Ted Cruz because he made some comments the other day about Marco Rubio. Yeah. And they were just total non sequiturs. I mean, it was a jumble of thoughts, and
it's unusual for him.
Yeah, and it was just like, you know, if you buy in a Marco Rubio, you're an appeaser like Obama, and you're supporting Islamic militancy. It was really odd.
It was odd because he's so very scripted, and for him to just kind of make these statements like that, it was very.
The other thing, he made that comment about if people were coming across from the Rio Grande who were lawyers and bankers, we'd be talking a different story. And I couldn't really understand exactly what his main point was, but I had to laugh because he's a lawyer and his wife's a banker. So, I mean, it's just like,
that usually works.
But Rubio is, I mean, Rubio again in the last Republican, he always wins the debate. He always does the best. And again, he's starting to appear on more of the Sunday shows. He was very good today.
He was good today. I agree with you.
Exceptionally good today. Yeah. He's you can't fluster him. I think the big question is he continues to make the generational case. And I thought Martin O'Malley made the generational case when we need. He said we can't look forward with figures from the past. So he's making his case to the Democratic voters. But it seems to me that at this moment, I think Marco Rubio is the guy to beat. And I cannot believe that some of the major money people haven't put the screws to Jeb Bush more than they have, but we'll see what happens, whether he can make a comeback or not. We are out of time. Again, we've had a lot of conversation this evening. Thanks for joining us. I'm very sorry that we were not able to take the phone calls this evening because of some faulty telephone equipment that we're dealing with. But our thanks to our guests around the table this evening, and thanks to Colin Bobbitt and to Dan Dorfman and to our director tonight, Dylan Klauke, for making this program possible. Until next Sunday night, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City. Just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown is a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.